Welcome to the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast. On this podcast, let's step aside from our busy lives to have fun, fascinating, life-giving conversation with inspiring authors, pastors, sports personalities, and other influencers, leaders, and followers. Sit back, grab some coffee, or head down the road, and let's get the good and gold from today's guest. Here's Jeff Pinkleton, Executive Director of the Gathering of the Miami Valley, where their mission is to connect men to men and men to God.
Hello, friends. Welcome again today to another episode of the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast, where we like to talk all things life, leadership, lessons therein. We tend to do that in a world of sports, of music, of comedy, pastors, authors, business, the like. Certainly, we like to talk all things men. And today is an exciting day. It is the first time ever a guest returns for episode number 3. And I couldn't be more blessed to have it be my friend, Pat Morley. Pat, welcome back. Episode 3.
Thank you, Jeff. That's pretty exciting.
How we pulled this off on you that you're still coming?
Well, it's just because I love you so much.
Well, I dearly love you, and we're going to cut right to it. I want to share 2 things out of the gate about you. I'm excited about your book we're going to get into called From Broken Boy to Mended Man, which has just released as of the taping of this. So it's out. And you have been so kind to give yourself to me for the next 2 years. We're going to start that up soon, where you're going to be my husband, mentor. Everything that you and Patsy have learned together is going to ooze out onto me as a husband to my wife, Kara. And you gave that such an easy yes. I was blown away at how easy that yes was. You made the comment to me when I asked you, you go, Jeff, 8 hours over 2 years, I could spend 8 hours in one sitting to you. And I said, well, you need a lot more prayer than I realized you needed. Do you regret those words yet? Do you go back in time and say, Lord, yeah, I shouldn't have said that?
Pretty excited to do that.
And you sent me this email this morning that just kind of blew me away. I mean, I read through it, and then I went back and read through it again. I sent it. I got to bring up Phil Elmore's name every time you're on here, because you guys will see each other soon. I know he's heading your way for 5 days, I think it is, and I see him quite a bit. And you said this to me. I'm just going to read it. This really hit me. Jeff, I've never seen a more thorough prep for a podcast. Amazing. I feel honored to be on with you, and the whole thing already feels like it exalts Jesus. That's the key thing, exalting Jesus. Just reading this over completely changed my mood this morning. To God be the glory. Then you highlighted my purpose, which we're going to get into a little bit. You said to help as many men as possible identify and heal their childhood wounds, break the cycle for their own families, and become more devoted followers of Jesus. It's all connected. Second part, you said, greatest regret, highlighted. We're going to get into that. That's so easy. And it's just, this hit me so hard what you said here. You said that the church I grew up in wasn't ready for my dad when he showed up with my mom, 3 younger brothers, and me. I will always wonder how our family might have turned out differently if there had been a group of men who understood what's at stake when a young man screws up enough, courage to reach out his hand for the door handle of a church. You went on to say, if they had understood how God sovereignly orchestrates those moments and all the prayers of those mothers, grandmothers, and aunties to make it happen, and all the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms trying to keep it from happening. We're getting into spiritual warfare there. Then you go on to say, if there had been some men who had a vision to take my dad under their wings and show him the ropes, to disciple him to become a godly man, husband and father. That's what my dad wanted. That's why he showed up. What if there had been some men who would have sat around a table and discussed 4 questions? When a young man brings his young family to our church, the 4 questions are, why did he just do that? What are the problems he's trying to solve? What does he and his family need from us? Man, this is just so simple at the end. How can we give it to him? It's just so unfair. Even as I write these words, I feel a sadness welling up inside me for what happened to my dad. He wanted to break the cycle. He never had a dad. His father abandoned your dad, Pat's dad, when he was 2 years old. I thank my dad for trying. I'm sad no one was there to help him. Now, what is that like? You wrote it, but now you're hearing it back. Someone else reading it to you. What does that say?
Well, first of all, it makes me want to cry. And this is the reason that I'm able to write or have to write a book to help younger men and older men who have grown up like my dad, or maybe they've had a father in the home like I did, with a father who didn't know how to be a dad. So some of the guys that would listen to this podcast, or some of the women too, would have fathers who wanted to do the right thing, fathers and mothers who wanted to do the right thing. So whatever mistakes they would have made would have been out of ignorance, not malice. But I also recognize that there are some people who will hear this podcast who had angry, demanding, and belittling parents who really tore them down. One of my best friends, Jim Seibert, who ran our Bible study, I was the teacher. He's the administrator here in Orlando for 17 years. His father, one day, Jim was playing with one of his best friends at Jim's house, and little Timmy was getting ready to go home. And so Jim, his father, opened the door with Jim and Timmy right there and said, well, Timmy, come back anytime. He said, you know, I sure wish I had a son like you, right in front of my friend Jim. Well, you know, he just never got over that. When I say never got over that, he literally never, ever got over that.
How could you?
Actually you can. And that's why I wrote this book, From Broken Boy to Mended Man. That doesn't mean you might not walk with a limp, but you can. You don't have to be the prisoner of that. Our wounds, guys, if you're listening, our childhood wounds may describe us, but they do not have to define us.
Well, you told the story about Jim, and you also tell a story in the book that was fascinating to me about a friend told you the story about the dad who I think went to a basketball game and was hearing all this stuff about his son. And he said, I'm so busy with work. I'm so busy with whatever. Can you tell me about my son? And it just seems so far-fetched. And yet at the same time, it felt so like, nah, that probably could and does happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't someone you personally had dealt with and known, but how do you respond even to that? Like you pile that on to stuff you dealt with, you hear what Jim went through. I mean, like you said, I mean, the emotions, the tears, the numbness. I mean, there's just so many things at play there that it's just devastating.
Yeah. Well, I feel like what happened to my dad and my mom and our family was so unfair. What I didn't say, you'd said in the pre-email that one of the questions you might ask, well, you gave me several things you might ask, and one of them would be, what is your greatest regret? And I just said, well, that's so easy. It's that my dad, what happened to my dad, what he didn't get. And as a result of that, I think they did the best that they could. But I have no recollection of ever hearing the words, I love you. I have no recollection of ever hearing the words, I'm proud of you. I can't ever remember hearing my parents say, you know, we believe in you, or anything about the purpose and meaning of life, or about how to have a relationship with God, or here are some things you might want to think about for career options, or here's some things you might want to know about sex, or just really any of it. I don't have any recollection of ever being hugged. Now, here's the thing. I'm not saying that those things never happened. It seems inconceivable to me that those things never happened. But as my counselor pointed out, the fact that I cannot remember them is significant in and of itself. So my mom and dad really did not have the equipping to be godly parents to my three younger brothers and me. I quit high school in the middle of my senior year. We're not going to talk about it, but it's like one of those sentences in the Bible, you know, 200,000 people died on that day, I mean, there's a lot more to that story for me to quit high school in the middle of my senior year. My next brother, he followed in my footsteps and eventually died of a heroin overdose. And my two younger brothers have had far more than their fair share of problems. And Jeff, my dad just never saw it coming. Now, the thing is, if dad was here today, he would say, well, I take full responsibility for what happened to my family. And you have to love that. Wish more men would do that. But as I've come to see it, I do believe that the church is culpable for what happened to our family, the church, the body of Christ. Other men should have understood what was going on and what my dad needed and helped him. And as you might imagine, I came along with a pretty low view of the church, right? But as a young man, when my life, when I was starting to repeat the cycle, right? I also, like my dad, knew that the one place that a man should be able to turn to receive the kind of help that he needs would be the church. And so Patsy and I had been married. I was already about to blow that up after a few months. We had a very awkward start to our marriage because I didn't know anything about being married. But I reached out for the door handle of a different church. And Jeff, those guys were ready for me. And they took me under their wings, discipled me. One man in particular, Jim Gillian, he saw something in me that I had never seen in myself. He spoke words of encouragement and hope into my life. And it just sort of unchained something inside of me. And so I became a follower of Jesus because of the example of these men.
Two things that really stood out to me in the book. I haven't finished it. There's so much there. And I really respect Pat, and I want you to hear this, that you've written so many things. You're kind of like John Maxwell talking about leadership. You've written so many things about men. You could probably sit down within some level of time frame and write a book, and a lot of it could just be from memory. Like, you've done such a deep dive year after year, writing a new book each year. But you really erred on getting personal, talking about counseling, talking about this deep dive you had gone through after your mother's death. And you talk about two things in there that fascinate me. You said one was your parents were at a basketball game for your son, and you commented about how proud you are of your kids. And your mom alluded to, like, wow, we've just never really kind of communicated that, or something like that. And right there was the moment where she could have said, I'm proud of you, and it never happened. And then you also, on the opposite end of that, I really appreciate that you said, if your parents were here today and you were to sit down and go over the content of this book, you're like, they'd be okay with it. Like, they would understand and own what this book is about, and you're doing what you can to honor them, to tell the truth. Man, that's got to be so hard to juxtapose all that you're saying. And I think it's tough because as parents, I remember, if I'm correct on this, my mom can listen later and correct me. When I was growing up, I think with my parents, my mom was probably saying, I love you regularly. My dad really wasn't, but I started saying it more just knowing, well, okay, as a young man in his family, then I need to take some ownership here to use the term I love you regularly in my family. And then we all kind of started doing it. My dad and I, now every time we get off the phone, we say, I love you. But that didn't always happen. So how do you juxtapose, like, your family didn't know better, and yet they could see it now and own, like, yeah, what you're saying in this book that's hard towards them? I don't know. It's just such a gray matter to me.
Well, the arc of this book, Jeff, is this. I want to help men understand and then heal from childhood wounds. But first, before you can solve a problem, you have to unravel it and understand it.
You did personally.
But I don't want to wallow in it either. Does that make sense? So this is not in the book, and this is actually a little off, almost off point, but it's relevant. Viktor Frankl, the survivor of Auschwitz, wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And in the book, he tells the story of a diplomat who came to him. He developed a division of psychotherapy. So a diplomat came to him for help who had been seeing a psychiatrist, I think it was a psychiatrist or maybe a psychologist. And the diplomat didn't like his work. He didn't like being a diplomat. And so he was talking to this psychologist about this for years. And the psychologist was exploring the deep meanings of his relationship with his father and things like that. And nothing changed. And so he came to see Frankl, and Frankl said, "Well, do you like being a diplomat?" He said, "No, I really don't." He said, "Well, why don't you get a different job and see if that might help?" The guy said, "I think I'll try that." So he stopped being a diplomat, got another job, and his life turned around. He became quite happy. So we don't want to wallow in these childhood wounds. But here's the thing. Many men today are angry. They're lashing out. They're destroying or damaging their relationships. Or alternatively, they withdraw and pout. And sometimes they do both within minutes of each other. They have no idea why they're doing it. In the book, help them identify why that behavior is there, where it comes from. But then more importantly, once we understand it, what we can do about how we can heal. So I take men through. Part one is really unraveling what happened to you. Then part two is about healing your childhood wounds, taking guys through a biblical process that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. And then the third part of the book, this is the arc of the book. The third part of the book is breaking the cycle for your own marriage, children, and with your friends and other men.
So for someone like me who leads the gathering of the Miami Valley, where we connect men to men and men to God, and the Phil Elmores, who are area directors for Man in a Mirror, and we want to take, you know, 8 to 12 guys through this book. This is not just any book. What had we better be prepared for in doing a book like this? Because this is not little neat and tidy, show up and be together and talk about it for 45 minutes and then, okay, we'll see you in 2 weeks. What had guys better be prepared for?
Changed life.
But there's a price to that. So what's the price that they better be equipped and ready to know is coming? Because I don't think changed life, I don't have any doubt that that's true.
Yeah, well, there will be a couple of points in the book, which will be like light bulbs going off early on, epiphanies that will be, you know, knowledge is power. I was just telling somebody in the meeting that I had before this that I can handle any amount of bad news. What I can't handle is not knowing what's going on. And when a man is in turmoil, inner turmoil, maybe he's like a powder keg ready to explode at any moment and doesn't even know why, what sets him off, or he gets his feelings hurt very easily. And then as a pity party, and these are things that have described me in the past, by the way, and doesn't understand why. Well, knowledge is power, and understanding how those things come about, why they're happening, that in and of itself is very liberating. Just that. But we don't want to leave it there either. What we want to do is help men then go on from there and then go through a process of facing the truth and then getting out of denial and then going through a process of forgiveness and repentance and whatever else needs to take place. And so this is a step-by-step book. You know, it's interesting, Jeff. So you're my second podcast on the book, but I know you personally, whereas I didn't know the other guy. Some books you can hear about in a podcast, and honestly, you can get enough information so you don't really need to buy the book, okay? This is not one of those books.
Sure.
I mean, I've written books that are like that, where I can give you the core principles, you know, in a 1 hour podcast. This is not that book. This is a book that really is best experienced and enjoyed, really, because there's such power in the exercises and going through the reflection exercises and the charts and filling the things out and really just going through the process of examining, you know, who you are and how you got to be the man you are today.
Well, let me support what you're saying. So, you know, I took some notes, I highlighted, like I said, there's too much here for me to get through it. So I got partway through it, but you know, I'll tell you one section for me that was only a couple pages long, but I'm like, I'm going to have to stay in this as a resource for other people. And I don't typically think of myself with the word I'm getting ready to use, but I, man, you just hit it so hard, was being oversensitive and how people misread what other people intend. And there was a lot of, I mean, it felt like when I get my cell phone cord out and I've wrapped it too tight or something and I have to spend a whole lot longer kind of pulling that thing apart. I thought that oversensitive section, which isn't much, it's a couple pages, but I'm like, man, there's a lot for people to digest if they stumble into that and can't find their way out. So is there anything you want to say about the oversensitive part? Because like I said, that was just one little part of the book, but I felt like there was a lot there.
Yeah, something you said earlier in the podcast really hurt my feelings, Jeff, and I wanted to talk to you about that.
There's probably any number of things I would say offensive in any few minutes of a podcast.
So there are different groups like Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon. Different groups have their lists. Adult children of alcoholics, they have their list. So I felt like we needed a list of characteristics that describe broken boys, boys that have childhood wounds that are walking around with the leftover pain of childhood wounds, that hard to put into words, lingering leftover pain from childhood wounds, and perhaps are not really even aware of why they are like they are. That was my situation. My mother died when I was 53. I didn't feel anything. I wasn't sad. I didn't cry. I didn't miss her, like zero. And I thought that I'm 53 years old. I thought that was pretty strange. So I made an appointment with a counselor to figure out what was going on. And she's the one who helped me put into words, finally articulate the father and mother wounds that I'd never been able to describe. So there are probably men listening to this podcast that do not understand fully the source of that, those nine characteristics that I put in the book. So I developed a list of nine characteristics. So, you know, I am a scholar practitioner, so I'm not a clinician. Don't want to make that claim here in this particular area, but I do have a certain skill at developing taxonomies and systematizing things. And so I came up with a list of nine. And so I think that most men, when they read that through that list, would identify with many or perhaps all of those nine characteristics. And then also, I realize that there may be other characteristics that a man might have that are not on that list, that thoughts of which might be triggered by looking at these nine things. But yeah, so the first characteristic is you have a hard time believing that people care about you. And
I definitely related to that one.
Yeah, that's me. And so why do I feel that way? Well, my mom and dad were in the picture, and I know that my mom and dad loved me, even though they never said that, because as an adult, we ended up reconciling. I talk about this in the book. And developing a beautiful relationship, but we never really got to the root of it. And that was what happened when I was a child and my brothers as well. We never really talked about it. So we sort of brushed it under the carpet, so it never got dealt with. And so part of the purpose of the book is just to really help guys think through that. So yeah, so she passed away and went through this counseling, figured out what was going on. And then that allowed me to grieve the childhood that I had missed. So I put that first characteristic that I have a hard time believing people really care about me, because as my counselor said, even though my mom and dad were in the picture, there was gross abandonment. Mm. When she said that, I wanted to throw her through the window. I really did. I mean, I was so upset with the counselor. I said, and I defended my parents, but she had me think about it and write down some things. And I realized that, you know, even though my parents wanted to do the right thing, they didn't.
Yeah.
And our family was dysfunctional. My parents were passive and they were permissive. So they didn't, like when I was dating Patsy, she said, you know, I think your parents gave you too much say when you were growing up. In other words, I ran wild basically. But the reason I'm saying all this is that the reason my parents, the effect of them being passive and overly permissive is that I felt abandoned by my mom and dad. I mean, I grew up feeling abandoned. Now, I didn't know that, and I didn't have that word even until I was 53 years of age, you see. But my counselor helped me understand that I'd been abandoned. And Eric Erickson, the psychologist, I quote him in the book, the first task of adolescence or childhood is trust versus mistrust. And so when a little boy doesn't grow up feeling like he's the gleam in his mother's eye and his daddy's eye, then he grows up to be a little boy with a hole in his soul. And that was me. And so from the age of 10 years on, I basically made the decision, well, if my parents don't want me, then I don't need them either. Mm. And so I pretty much started distancing myself from my parents when I was 10 years old.
Wow, so tough. I haven't asked you this before. Do you tend to write morning, evening, middle of the day, any time of day? Do you have give me a quick answer there, because I want to go somewhere with that.
Yeah. Well, I'm a very disciplined person, so I do write consistently, and I write in the morning. I start very early.
So when you would wake up during this book, I'm guessing more so than others, man, it would feel like in my heart there would have to be a lot of prep work. Like, okay, this is not just writing a book about men that you know something about, you know, any number of your books. Were this, I mean, you clearly put yourself in there way more than you ever had to, in and throughout, talking about counseling and, you know, just everything about it. What was it like processing that and writing on a given, and you were probably writing days back to back, I'm sure plenty of that time. I mean, were you going through it again? Were you feeling it? Were you like, okay, not as much today as what I'd planned? Or what's that like as a process?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure everybody understands this is not a book about me. This is a book about you. It's not like a memoir or anything like that. But what I've done is I've made myself extremely vulnerable because,
amen.
Because I have. And it's the most personal of the 23 books that I've written. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but the last sign of intimacy is sharing secret joys. And so I don't know your listeners, so I'm a little hesitant to say this, but let me just say this. I loved writing this book. I loved every minute of it. There is some sense in which I had to relive everything.
Yeah.
And so
there, no doubt.
But let me also say that through that process of reliving everything, that was also healing to another level that I didn't even know was possible. Mm. So I'm grateful for that. In fact, in the afterword in the book, you said you're not there yet, but in the afterword of the book, I encourage all the men to reread the book for this reason. Mm. It's like the movie that you watch and you love that movie. But then you went back and you rewatched it, and because you know the whole arc of the book, everything means so much more the second time around. And I really believe this is one of those kinds of books.
That's giving you a lot of props and bonus points with your publisher too. They're like, wow, yeah, go tell them to read it again. And then when the next one comes out, read that one like three times through. So,
well, that's not buying it again.
That's true. That's true. But it's promoting it to other people probably too. So let me ask you this, because you alluded to something a minute ago about your folks not telling you they loved you, but you kind of knew they did. I really struggle with that, because my mom used to tell me a lot when I was growing up, when we would look at other situations and other people, whatever the case may be, and she would use language like, but they love in their own way. Or I've heard people say, kind of like you did, this person never said they loved me, but I know they did. A, can that really be true? And I just think, for anybody, you want to hear it. You need to hear it. It's great to hear it. How do we reconcile that?
Well, when I said that I know that they love me, I know that they love me because of something that happened when I was 35 years of age. Not because of what I believed growing up. Growing up, I was pretty convinced that they didn't care about me because there was no verbal affection. There was no physical affection. And so when I left home, when I quit high school, I pretty much, you know, I washed my hands. I was gone as far as I knew. And if it wasn't for Patsy, my wife, I probably wouldn't have had any contact with them at all. I think the best word to describe the relationship was estranged. So, but then I became a follower of Jesus, and that changed everything. And I came to a place in my early 30s where I started longing, and I think I probably would have wanted this anyway, but especially because of Jesus, where I was aching to have a relationship with my mom and dad again. We were still going out there because of my wife. We were going out there for, you know, Easter and Christmas and maybe 4th of July picnic, something like that. But I really wanted to reconnect with my dad. So I invited my dad to lunch when I was in my early 30s on his birthday. And we had a wonderful time. And so we decided that we would do it again the next year and then the next year. When I was 35 years of age, after lunch on his birthday, December 12, we were walking out to our cars. I had a car. He had a truck. He was a working man. And we were parked next to each other. And I said, I don't remember. I have no idea why I said this. I said, "Dad, can I give you a hug?" And like I say, at that point, I don't remember ever having had that hug. But anyway, before the words were out of my mouth, my dad was charging me like a bull. And he threw his arms around me and he squeezed the breath out of me and like a grizzly bear. And he let out this deep, primordial sounding groan. Must have lasted 20 seconds. Very guttural. And when he 20 seconds had gone by or whatever it was, seemed like 20 minutes, but we drew back from each other and had our hands on each other's shoulders, and tears were rolling down both of our faces. And I said, "I love you, Dad." And he said, "I love you too, son." And that was the first time I ever remember hearing from either parent the words, "I love you." I was 35 years of age. But it radically transformed our family. We never spoke about that. To my knowledge, I know I never spoke about it to anybody. I don't think he would have either. He's a pretty quiet guy. But it transformed our family, Jeff. From that day forward, our family became a bunch of lovers, a bunch of reckless lovers. I mean, it was ridiculous. I remember a few months after that, talking to my brother on the phone, my younger brother on the phone one day. And at the end of the phone call, he said, "Well, I love you, Pat." And I said, "Well, I love you too." And he said, "Well, I love you more than you love me." And I'm thinking, you know, who are you? And what did you do with my brother, you know? And I said, "Well, it doesn't make any difference what you say. I love you more than you love me. I always have, always will." And I laughed and I hung up the phone before he could say anything else.
Oh, that's great. So in that moment, Pat, did you know when you were getting ready to do that, you guys had just had this good time together. It hadn't happened. You're getting ready to say it. Did you know? I mean, you had to say in your mind, there's a risk reward thing here. And
I wasn't thinking, Jeff.
Really?
This just happened. This was a Holy Spirit moment. Yeah,
well, clearly.
But I'm going to go beyond that and say that, yeah, I had to wait until I was 35. You may be older than that. You may be younger than that. You don't have to wait. And in the book, I'm going to walk you through how you can get to the point where you can have these kinds of reconciling moments. Now, it doesn't necessarily just have to be, you know, the I love you thing, although that's a big thing. But all of the different parts of the relationship. One of the big goals of the book is really it's to help men have a more compassionate view of our parents. Now, I realize somebody's listening and saying, you're crazy. You have no idea what my dad was like. He was a wicked, evil man. And that might be true. And it might not be possible to reconcile that relationship. But here's the thing. Jesus teaches unilateral forgiveness. Unilateral forgiveness. So Jesus doesn't say in the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our sins as we forgive others their sins when they come to us on humble bowed knee and tearfully repentant for all the sorrow they've caused us. He doesn't talk about it that way. He talks about forgiving 70 times, seven times. That's hyperbole for however many times it's needed. So in the book, I'm going to help men work through these wounds and get to a point, get out of denial, face the truth, and get to a point where they can, by faith, not necessarily by what they feel at the moment, but by faith, can forgive their father and or their mother for the things they either did or failed to do as a child. So you, if you're listening, your parents might have been neglectful or absent, maybe you only had a single parent and one of the parents was not in the home at all, or maybe both of them, who knows, maybe you're raised in the foster system or by relatives, or maybe you were abused as a child. There's no amount of, and I covered the whole abuse thing in the book as well. Or maybe your parents were just angry all the time at you and you could never do anything right. It doesn't make any difference. No matter how you got your childhood wounds and no matter how messed up you are because of them, the process for becoming amended man is the same in every case. And it's a biblical process. It's been around for thousands of years, and I'm going to help walk you through that so that you can face these demons that keep waking you up in the middle of the night and make them go away.
Yeah, I'm in a pretty healthy place with definitely family and some other relationships. I'd say most all of them, but I can't wait to get there. I'm excited to get to that point in the book. You know, it's interesting. I've been watching this show on Netflix, got kind of addicted to it over the weekend, which I don't usually have that happen in my life, but I did. A pastor friend of mine had referenced this series, and I thought, well, I'm going to check it out. Got totally sucked in, called Love on the Spectrum, and it's about people on the autism spectrum wanting to find love and just their... just outlandish way they go about expressing, I want love. I want to have a mate. And you know, the autism thing I think has really picked up speed in our country in recent years, recent time or whatever. But I loved how honest people are talking about this. I've said, I might've even said it to you before, Pat. I can't remember a time when, now this almost contradicts what I'm getting ready to say. I can't remember a time when someone told me they loved me that I didn't stop and remember it. Like in that moment, I'm like, wow, they just said they love me. I think we're dying to hear it all the time. I have a hunch I'm getting ready to say that in the next 5 minutes, just so you know. But I think it means something to us. I think we want it. I think we want to give it. And kind of closing with this, because I'm going to keep it off the rapid five, and we're at a good place to stop the conversation for your sake and to move on. And as always, you're so gracious and generous with time. But talk a little bit before we close about counseling, because you're not shy about that in here. You embrace it. You went through it. I almost feel like there's a little bit of like we can almost go overboard talking about it to say, hey, look at me, and it's a trophy and I'm not afraid of it, which is very minimal to people who do that probably, if they do. But then we're so fearful of it. Ooh, what if people know I have a counselor? What if people know I went to this therapist? Or what if people know if, I said something about social work or a counselor, and oh, that was for me, not me being in that profession. So how would you help people break the cycle even of a thought pattern that says, ooh, counseling bad, you're admitting to some struggles that you shouldn't have to admit to?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I do think that the stigma for going to counseling has changed a lot. I think it's also a little bit of a generational thing. I think younger people are a little bit more open to embracing counseling. Also, we are in a mental health crisis in the United States right now, especially among younger people, with 60% of youth having depressive thoughts, many of them even having suicidal ideation. We're in a terrible mental health crisis. And so biblical counseling, which is what I'm doing in the book here, biblical advice, there's a tremendous power in that to release. So here's the thing. If counseling can really, really help you, and you were the enemy, what is the thing that you would most want to do? You would want to keep that person from getting the help that they need. So there is a spiritual warfare, I think, surrounding this issue of getting counseling. It's like men's discipleship. Men's discipleship, which are the bigger rubric mm-hmm. under which we're operating here. We know that if we get men right, we get marriages right. If we get marriages right, we get families right. If we get families right, we get churches right. If we get churches right, we get communities right.
You can't say that enough.
There's some sense in which all those areas are groups of people are important, but there is some sense in which if you get the man right, everything else will fall into place. But if you don't get the man right, nothing else can fall into place. And so if you were the devil trying to keep the man mired in the anger and the self-pity of childhood wounds, that would be a primary goal.
Yep.
So, you know, I do think we're fighting against that a little bit.
Yep. I totally agree.
Oh, okay. So let's write a book so the guys don't actually have to go into a counselor's office and sneak out the back door. Let's write a book. Let's call it From Broken Boy to Mended Man. Let's subtitle it A Positive Plan to Heal Your Childhood Wounds and Break the Cycle.
Amen.
And then let's see if we can't help some of these guys take it to the next level. Guys, helping you make sense of your life, that's why I exist. That's what my writings and my teachings have always been about.
Well, we could have spent a lot more time on this. This is almost like three podcasts could be had just on this book. It's out where books are sold, Amazon, other places. But Pat, I just want to say to you, I love you, and I could give you a lot of reasons why. You've been so kind and good to me. I remember the early days of The Gathering back in 2008 when we're talking about books and what we're going to do. And two of the first books we really did were Kent Hughes' book, The Disciplines of a Godly Man, and Man in a Mirror. And my mentor and friend, and I think you know him, Bill Brown, used to be the president of Cedarville. He was one of the people who got us in that loop. But your accessibility to me, you're being willing to say yes to help me as a husband over the next couple of years. The fact that we both have to ride the ship together to love Phil Elmore well. People, please pray for us. But Phil probably needs prayer too. But Pat,
he's being funny, folks.
That's Phil, right. Phil's great. But I love and respect just how focused you are. And you're not, I say it to you every time, you're not trying to be in 20 lanes. And you know, when I just asked Phil today to speak, or I asked him last week, followed up with him today about speaking at a men's breakfast for a friend of mine at another church. And he's speaking in Anderson, Indiana at another church with you guys' content with Man in a Mirror. And I just think what you've done and how you've lived your life and staying in that lane and the way God has blessed the ministry of Man in a Mirror is so phenomenal. And again, there's a lot to love about you, but bottom line, I love you. And thanks for being on again.
Love you.
Love you too, Pat. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us on the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast. You can reach Jeff at gatheringmiamivalley.org or find us on Facebook at The Gathering of the Miami Valley. Join us again next week for another honest and rich conversation.
The Rise FM Podcast Network.